Well, we can sort of tongue-in-cheek look back at the Great Depression and say, wasn't it awful? But it was pretty awful. And now the stock market wound up its worst September, we found out today, since the Great Depression. We don't know whether or not we're going to war with Iraq. We've seen a way steep decline in expectations for corporations. And we're worrying about our economy when it comes to stock. The Dow posted its steepest September loss since 1937, when FDR was president and Adolf Hitler was getting ready to launch World War II. Boy, I hope that doesn't bode any kind of parallel for us here. Welcome back. This is True Talk 800 AM. I'm Mary Sarrett. I just finished reading a book called Rethinking the Great Depression, A New View of the Consequences and the Causes of the Great Depression. Now, a couple of things I wanted to find out. First of all, what was this all about? Growing up, I had to listen to my father telling stories about just how awful it was. It got to be a joke around our house. Okay, my brothers and I would roll our eyes and say, here comes another depression story. Now I'm looking around at things and wondering, what is going on today in our economy that would parallel what happened in 1929? I also wanted to know what we could do differently. I also found out in reading this book that perhaps government interference makes things worse. Joining us now is a professor from Marquette University, the author of this book. He's a professor of economics at Marquette. He's a specialist in economic theory and American economic history. And believe it or not, there is an economic book that I can read and understand. The author of Rethinking the Great Depression, Gene Smiley. Professor, nice to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
I did enjoy your book, and I found out a whole lot about what was going on back in 1929. Perhaps you can tell us where we're at, and does that parallel what happened before the Great Depression?
Well, there are really a lot of differences between where we're at now and where we were at that point in time just before the Great Depression or at the start of the Great Depression. We haven't had the same international problems that we had during the Great Depression. Now, the international reasons which brought on the Great Depression didn't necessarily have to result in such a long and severe contraction. They were made much worse by government policies which ostensibly were to ease the problems of the Great Depression, but in fact they made it worse and they made it much longer than it would have been. And we're finally, I think, beginning to realize just what we did wrong, primarily just getting in there and trying to do something, not knowing what we were doing and not knowing exactly how we should do it, actually made things much worse than they would have been otherwise. We're not quite in the same type of a situation today. We've had some problems. It's not so much related to past September 11th as it is to that we had, I guess you could call it, I hate to use these terms, an irrational exuberance about the so-called dot-com revolution.
That sounds like a very apt way to describe it.
Well,
totally out of control.
It's not so much it was out of control. It was that there were expectations built up which, in retrospect, simply couldn't have been fulfilled. A lot of people thought that the dot-com, the Internet revolution, would result in much greater changes and particularly much greater advantages for Internet firms than what they actually did. And it took a while, it took a few years to begin to realize that those expectations simply couldn't be borne out. So the stock market has been adjusting to that for about the past year, year and a half, among other things.
Now, weren't there two depressions in one? I read in your book that there was kind of a mini-depression in between the beginning and the end of the big depression.
Well, I'm an economist, first of all, okay, so you have to follow me along in our logic. And an economist looks at a depression, they define a depression as a period of falling real GDP. So the Great Depression, from an economist viewpoint, lasted from the early summer of 1929 until about the first quarter of 1933. And after that, the economy began to recover very slowly and very unevenly until about May of 1937. And then a new depression occurred. And although this depression wasn't as long and it was much shorter, it actually was very severe. The economy contracted very quickly between May of 1937 and May of 1938. So there were really two depressions in there. The Great Depression of 1929 to 1933, which was very long and very severe, and the short but very severe depression of 1937-1938, what many people call the Roosevelt Depression.
All right. There was also a depression going on in Europe, am I right?
The Great Depression was worldwide. And the depression in European countries varied in terms of length and severity depending on what the country was. It was extremely severe in Germany, and it actually started in 1928, well before it started in the United States. It was not as severe in England and not as severe in France, although it lasted a little longer in France. And in most of the European countries, excluding Central Europe, it wasn't quite as severe and quite as long as it was in the United States. In most of the European countries, it was over by about 1931, as many of them went off the gold standard, which was, you know, in many ways the cause of this Great Depression, and went to, you know, control the floating exchange rate, then the depression ended. Britain stayed on until the fall of 1931, and that's when their depression ended. France stayed on until 1936, and so they really didn't begin to recover in France until 1936, although the depression wasn't nearly as severe in France. In the United States, once we stopped, we went off the gold standard, which was in 1933, then we began the process of recovering also.
Now, explain what the gold standard has to do with the ups and downs.
The gold standard is a way to relate currencies of different countries. And so what the gold standard does is to say each country's currency is defined in terms of units of gold. So many ounces of gold correspond to $1 or 1 franc. And those are fixed. And then because you have each country's exchange rate is fixed in terms of gold, then every country's exchange rate is fixed. For example, I think it was $4.86 for 1 British pound. Now, the other thing about the gold standard is that each country was bound to not only define its money in terms of gold, but that was the official unit of money in a society. And therefore, if there were dollars, currency outstanding, you had to have gold to back up those dollars, because you could always, if you didn't want to hold the currency, you could always go to the Federal Reserve Bank and demand to be paid in lawful money, which was, in fact, gold coin.
Not anymore, huh?
Not anymore. That ended in 1933.
All right. Now, let me ask you, why were things worse here economically than in many countries or in some countries during the Depression?
Because we adopted a set of policies which made the Depression much worse.
Government policies?
Government policies.
Like what?
First of all, the Federal Reserve System decided that they would not attempt to stop the money supply from contracting. In fact, in many ways, they helped it to contract. Well, as the stock of money falls, then the price level has to fall to try to, you know, get to a point where the amount of money outstanding can buy all the goods which would be purchased at full employment. And what you find every time you have a severe deflation like this is that in the interval you have sharply falling real production and real employment as those prices are falling. And the Federal Reserve System didn't take any steps to try to stop the falling prices. The Federal Reserve System didn't take the steps that it could have taken to stop the failure of banks in the United States. And that was what they were originally created to do. Now, think what happens if a bank closes back then. There's no deposit insurance. So when a bank closed its doors, everything was frozen in the bank. Whatever you had in your savings account, or your time deposit, or your checking account, that was completely frozen. And you couldn't get at it until that bank was liquidated. If you were a business and had an account there, that amount of money was frozen. In addition, if you were a business and been borrowing, that was your line of credit to be able to get to purchase things to sell, you know, operating funds, that was all frozen. You had to try to find some new place to obtain a line of credit to get working capital funds. In addition, all of those wealth that you had in the dollars in those accounts, that's all tied up. it may take 2-3 years before the bank is liquidated, and then they pay off the creditors, which are all the depositors. And if you're lucky, much of the time, you got back 60, 70, maybe 80 cents on the dollar. And so for 2 years, all the wealth you had listed, tied up in those accounts was frozen. You couldn't get at it.
No wonder. No wonder we saw. I mean, everybody's broke and nobody can move, and the whole thing has come to a screeching halt.
You know, the collapse of the banking system was just a terribly destructive force in this period of time. If we could have stopped the banking system from collapsing, then it would have been much less severe.
I want to, when we come back, Professor, I want to talk about the federal price and production controls and all of the things that the government did, which perhaps they thought they were doing a good thing, but they weren't doing a good thing and actually contributed to this thing being dragged out. Our guest this afternoon is the economics professor at Marquette University. He wrote the book Rethinking the Great Depression, Professor Gene Smiley. He's our guest this afternoon. Portions of our show sponsored by Hagen Food and Pharmacy and Good Eat. You are listening to True Talk 800 AM. I'm Mary Starrett. Do stay with us, and we'll be right back.
I am so not looking forward to this week's commercial for the Appliance Center at Northwest Natural Gas.
Why is that? It's such a great place with all those real-life gas-working fireplaces.
Oh, damn. The ad agency manager wants us to write a singing commercial for his daughter to sing.
The one that ruined the Christmas pageant?
That's the one.
She's going to sing about the heat and glow offer of $100 in free natural gas and their free remote control thermostat, a total value of $299, for any Appliance Center at Northwest Natural Gas customer who purchases a heat and glow insert, freestanding stove, or zero-clearance built-in fireplace that has furnace efficiency rating.
If she's screeching like a hoot owl, how are people going to get the message of $100 in free natural gas and a free remote control thermostat, a $299 value?
I should give up now and kill the announcer.
The Appliance Center at Northwest Natural on 8th between Division and Powell is your authorized heat and glow dealer for Portland.
Your home for the True Talk Story Hour with Odyssey and Focus on the Family Radio Theater. Saturday nights at 7 on True Talk 800 AM.
We talk about water all the time. We say our mouths water and we don't want to get into hot water. And blood is thicker than water and you can't mix oil and water. It's not all talk. We're even made of water. But what do you really know about your tap water? Do you know where it comes from or what's in it? Chances are you don't. But now you can. Your water supplier will soon be sending you a short new report about your drinking water. Look for it. And when you get it, read it, because this report really holds water. Learn more by calling your water supplier or 1-877-EPA-WATER.
Hi, this is John Whitehead, host of the public service campaign Freedom Under Fire. Have you ever been faced with a problem that threatens your freedom? Well, you've got a friend at the Rutherford Institute. Since 1982, our attorneys across America have defended people like you when civil liberties have come under fire. Do you have a legal question? Do you need help to solve problems at your school or in your workplace? Call our legal hotline at 804-978-3888. That's 804-978-3888. There is no charge for our services because freedom is under fire.
Defying description daily. Mary Sharon, True Talk, 800 AM.
Maybe you have heard, like I've heard, that the Great Depression of 1929 will look like a day at the beach compared to what we've got around the bend in our next depression. Are we facing one? Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Mary Starrett. This is True Talk 800 AM, and our guest is Marquette University Economics Professor Dr. Gene Smiley, who wrote the book Rethinking the Great Depression. Professor, maybe you can talk a little bit about what you point out in your book, is that we saw this terrible, terrible economic event, probably the most traumatic, as you point out, of the 20th century. Is that where government got to be really big and really bloated? Did we focus attention on how the government can be a safety net? Was this sort of the expansion of socialist types of mentalities?
In many ways, it really was. Now, government has been growing in terms of its share of the economy since, you know, for a very long period of time. But there was an excellent economist by the name of Robert Higgs who wrote a book on the economy. I can't think offhand of the name of it. But anyway, Robert Higgs argued that the Great Depression marked a change because it's not just big government in terms of size, it's big government in terms of going down and interfering with the economy, interfering with people's lives and the choices they have to make. And so that expansion of the government that occurred in the 1930s was, in many senses, literally unprecedented. And what it did was it said, we're no longer going to set the market. We think a problem with the Great Depression was we had this unfettered market economy. And so we've got to control the market economy. And so they begin to engage in what we would now call social engineering, going down and trying to remake businesses, remake markets in ways that the intellectuals who were brought in with Roosevelt thought were the most appropriate ways to do this. And that social engineering by these intellectuals was just a disastrous thing. And part of the problem was that you had various intellectuals who didn't have the same views, and so the laws that came out were incredibly inconsistent. And so you'd have laws trying to raise the prices of laborers at manufacturing firms relative to everything else. And then you had laws trying to raise the prices of farm products relative to everything else, relative to manufactured goods. And you had laws trying to raise the prices of manufactured goods relative to everything else, including farm products. None of it was consistent. You can't have everybody's wage or price go up relative to all the other wage and prices. It's physically impossible to do that. And yet that was the set of programs which essentially were passed in what was called the First New Deal. And the First New Deal literally stopped the recovery which was starting to take place. And for almost 2 years, from about September of 1933 through about July of 1935, literally nothing happened. No recovery took place because the New Deal, the First New Deal, literally stopped any incentive to really have a recovery.
So then would it be safe to say that government created the Great Depression and government exacerbated it by their programs?
Now, won't go so far as to say the government created it. The governments around the world, in their attempt to get back to a gold standard, when they couldn't get back to it and they were unwilling to let the gold standard work, and they were unwilling to redefine their currencies in terms of gold in ways which would have worked in the 1920s, brought on the Great Depression. But the fact that it was so much longer and more severe in the United States is, in my opinion, tragic testimony to the attempt by the federal government to interfere and to bring the economy back when it was doing everything wrong. For example, Herbert Hoover dramatically increased income tax rates in 1932, a tremendous increase in income tax rates, which just takes away the incentive of people to go out and try to earn more income, takes away the income that they could have used to purchase goods and services because you've engineered this. The banking system, the Federal Reserve System, it extended and lengthened the Great Depression. Then, when the Depression finally ended and we were starting to recover quickly between March and July of 1933, then the New Deal comes along, and the New Deal then just stops the recovery. Without the New Deal, we probably would have been fully recovered by somewhere in 1935.
So it was more like a raw deal than a New Deal.
Yeah, it was new, but it wasn't good, let's put it that way.
What happened in 1913? You say that the federal government imposed a progressive personal income tax back as far as 1913. Is that when things started going downhill in a hurry?
Well, I won't say that they started going downhill. The first income tax was, although it was a progressive income tax, it was very low. The rates were about 1% to 2%, and then they had a surtax, which raised the top marginal rate to 7% if you earned something like $1 million of adjusted gross income. But the passage of that income tax opened the door, because then very quickly by 1916, as they needed more funds to pursue the war, they raised the income tax rates. In 1918, when we went into the war, the income tax rates were raised so that the top rate, the top marginal rate, went from 7% all in 1913 all the way up to 76% in 1918. And, you know, those rates just choked off incentives to do things. People just took their income and they hid it from taxes. They put it in things where you couldn't tax it, things which weren't very productive. And so we choked off the economy, and we pulled down some of the rates down in the 1920s, but we never pulled them down to what they were in 1913 and 1914.
All right, so where do you see us now, and what do you predict with your crystal ball for us economically and perhaps another Great Depression?
Well, the first thing is, I would say that George Bush has done the right thing in reducing income tax rates, not in terms of trying to bring us back quickly, you know, to restore the economy, but in the long run, allowing us then to become more productive and to grow better. Okay, you know, any time you can push down those tax rates, which destroy the incentive to do things, you're going to be a lot better. We still have a federal government which spends too much, not just relative to the taxes that it takes in, but it spends too much relative to the economy. Too many resources are devoted to the federal and the state governments, taking those resources away from the private sector, where all the initiative, all the growth, all the entrepreneurial activity takes place. And so when you do that, you reduce the incentives to expand the economy and to grow and to raise incomes. So the first thing we've got to do is not just reduce the tax rates, you know, in general. We've got to reduce the size of government in general to allow us to begin to recover and to grow. We can become, once again, the envy of the entire world if we just free up the American economy and let people become free to do what it is they do best.
You know, Professor, you are obviously, I mean, I'm always amazed at people who are so learned in economics, because I don't have a clue. But you would think that that's such a basic point that political leaders and the powers that be would get, that if you take money away from the private sector, you stymie the efforts, and the only time anything gets done is when the private sector does it, because government doesn't create anything. So why is it that that very basic point just keeps getting lost?
All I can do is give you some conjectures. I think politicians have a different agenda. I'm not sure that their agenda really is to allow the private sector to go. They have an agenda in terms of what they think are social objectives, and that they want to pursue those social objectives, even if it's at the cost of reducing incomes and slowing down the rate of growth, because they don't think that's necessarily the most important thing. You know, I think politicians, whether they're in Salem in Oregon or in Madison, Wisconsin, or whether they're in Washington, D.C., begin to lose touch with, and I guess the best way to put it is with reality. They don't actually have to go out there and earn an income. Okay? They're getting their income from taxes, and so they lose touch with what it's like for real people to get out and work and to produce and to conceive of things and try to bring some new product or new service or new way of doing things to fruition. They just they don't have that touch anymore.
Boy, that's true. It's all about social engineering, isn't it? It's more like the more people we can get dependent on government largesse, the less likely we'll be to have a lot of these entitlements voted away, because so many people are getting their share.
Absolutely.
So any predictions on where we're going now, stock market, anything you want to throw out there for us?
I think it's going to recover. I don't think, you know, let's put it this way. I don't think that George Bush is going to do anything really dumb. And I think that given some time, what you've got to do now is begin to restore the public's confidence in businesses, because all of the revelations about, you know, phony bookkeeping and profits which weren't there, so they actually had losses, has really shaken the confidence of the public in terms of investing. So it's going to take a while for them to begin to become more confident. Secondly, you've got to allow the economy to more fully recover. Okay, and until you get more investment taking place in the economy, until the profits of the firms begin to rise, you're not going to see that much of a rise in stock market prices. So, you know, I said this in January of this year. I said this recovery is going to take a while, because you've had some fairly dramatic things which have changed the relationship between various firms and various industries. And it's going to take a while to shake those out, to move out, to reallocate resources where they have to go, and to change pricing structures. The airline industry, for example, is going to take a long time to redo the pricing structure to allow the airlines to become profitable once again. So we've still got a ways to go before this recession is over.
Before I let you go, can you tell me in 10 seconds whether or not you think we're going to go to war, and number two, if what that will do to the economy?
You know, I don't have any idea whether we're going to go to war. It's not going to be a good thing. It's going to shake the confidence, and it's going to cause, I think, the stock market to fall a little further. But then, my record on predictions like that are not very good. I'm reluctant to go out on the limb very far there.
Well, I tell you, you might not be great at predictions, but you sure are great at going back and looking at what happened in 1929, and it's evidenced in this book called Rethinking the Great Depression. And as I said, if somebody said to me, pick up a book written by an economics professor, I'd say, yeah, right, you're talking to someone who doesn't even balance her checkbook because there's just too many concepts there for her to grasp. But this was a book that I absolutely loved. I learned an awful lot, and I appreciate you being with us, Professor.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, take care.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
We'll take a break and then come back this afternoon.